United Lutheran Seminary presents the Seminary Explores podcast, conversations on faith, art, people, politics, theology, life, and more, with voices from around the corner and around the globe.
Good day. Welcome to the Seminary Explores. My guest today is Dr. Dennis O'Neill, who is the Deputy Fire Administrator at the U.S. Fire Administration in Emmitsburg, Maryland. Welcome to the Seminary Explores.
Oh, thanks, Dr. Strober. Very nice to be here with you.
Well, to begin our conversation, and before we get into the meat of our time together, I'd like to know, how is it that you became a firefighter?
Dr. Strobert, my dad was a firefighter in Jersey City, and when I came home from the Army, they, at the time, and it's still the case in New Jersey, if you are a veteran, you get preference during the civil service test, and so my dad kept bugging me to take the application. Of course, I was happy to be home, and
You're a veteran.
Yeah. So he filled out the application and made me sign it, and thank goodness he did. So I took the physical exam, the written exam, and got on the fire department. But it was really his motivation. It wasn't something that I sought. I just accidentally kind of wound up getting on the fire department.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
But, being in a city situation, you'd come across a lot of how would I put it? A lot of difficult situations.
Oh, sure, yeah,
right. But primarily of interest for me and for others was your involvement in 9/11. Now, how is it that you were involved? Got to go across the river,
sure.
Into that area.
Well, actually, it's kind of an interesting story, but it all gets down to interpersonal relationships, and that's pretty much how the world works if you haven't figured that out yet. When 9/11 happened, I had already been retired from the Jersey City Fire Department, and I, at the time, was the superintendent of the United States National Fire Academy, which is part of the fire administration. When the planes hit the building, most people don't realize it, but that was not a federal disaster when it happened. The only thing that made it a federal event was the fact that a plane was involved. And there was so much destruction that the federal government was trying to get into New York City to help New York City.
Right.
New York City government and the state government at the time they were kind of in so much shock, or there was so much overwhelm, that they didn't even know what to ask for.
Right, exactly.
You know, what do you do? So they kept saying, no, you know, we'll figure it out, and when we figure it out, we'll ask you for it. And the fire commissioner in New York City knew me from my time in the Jersey City Fire Department. We were friends.
Okay.
So during this conversation, and I wasn't a part of it, but during the conversation, the fire commissioner in New York City, Tom Von Essen, said, doesn't Dennis O'Neill work for you? Doesn't he work for FEMA? And they said, yeah. He said, okay, you can send Dennis up. And you know, that's how I wound up going up there, and then I took a team of folks with me, and essentially at that time, a blank check to give New York City whatever it is that they needed.
May I ask, what were your responsibilities?
More or less a couple of things. The entire communication systems was overwhelmed because that area, everybody was on their cell phones trying to call everybody else.
Right.
And the system got overloaded. The antennas for the communication systems for a lot of the city was in the World Trade Center building. So the ability of the fire department, the police department, and things like that to communicate had been threatened. I mean, other parts of the city were still good, but that particular area was incommunicado. They didn't know what kind of equipment that they needed, so I was more or less sitting down with them saying, okay, we can do this, we can do that. And in this thought and decision process, we came up with some first day, second day, third day kinds of things to work on.
And we're so used to communications and having it available. And I know at that time I received calls from people who could not communicate with people, mm-hmm. You know, and that was
well, now, Dr. Strober, to be honest with you, around the country, that is a concern of ours, because we no longer have people wired to phone systems.
Exactly.
It's all cell towers. So when we have wildland fires, when we have floods, when we have earthquakes, when we have lava eruptions, those cell towers are destroyed. Okay? And now people, we can't communicate with them.
Right. Indeed. Indeed. When you reflect on 9/11, what were some of the things, or can you recall some of the things that we as a public, general public, did not know was what was going on?
Sure. There were a couple of things that were going on. The first thing, and it really came back to a number of us that were there, realized that any time that there's an attack, one of the things that you always have to be wary of is a secondary attack. Now, we knew that the air system was shut down.
Right.
So we weren't concerned about an air attack. We were concerned about secondary bombs. We were concerned about secondary bombs that may have been in the planes. We were concerned about secondary bombs that may have been planted in that area before the event happened, because then what would happen is that you would have so many first responders, so many rescuers down there,
right,
that you would have taken out the city's ability to respond.
Exactly.
Okay. That concern escalated to, for example, they were bringing in a lot of food and a lot of water for the rescuers and the workers down there.
Right.
And my concern was, who's checking the food? What if somebody, all you have to do is poison one pint of water, needle in one syringe in one pint of bottle, and you would have had to shut the whole system down because you couldn't trust the water, you couldn't trust the food.
And yet those are the things that we think about. Well, they need water to, you know, to keep on going, you know, and need food. But there are people who might, you know, sabotage that effort.
Exactly. And you don't, and you, it's hard to tell who's well-meaning and who's ill-meaning.
Right.
In the middle of all of that chaos.
Oh, indeed. Indeed. Well, how do you get through that, though?
Yeah. Well, in the beginning, we didn't, to be candid with you. We were just trying to people with hand digging the pile, and but after a day or two, we set up security, we set up access points to the site, we started to check on who were the food vendors, where's this stuff coming from, and fortunately, the people that Gate donated early on in the process were good people that did us very well.
Can you recall like the numbers of first responders, firefighters that were involved?
It would be hard to do that because by the second day, people were showing up from all over the country. Firefighters were showing up unrequested in some cases, in a lot of cases. So I can tell you that probably that first week, thousands.
Okay.
But then again, we used the military. We set up access points. We had we had the Secret Service come in and start doing what they call it badging, which is the identification. And then, of course, being you and I are both from New York City, so of course there were people in the business of creating badges. Okay, because that if you got inside, you had access to the stores. That were damaged, and you could steal stuff.
Exactly, great. Right. People do crazy things.
Yeah. So then they started badging every day, and you know there was all secret passwords and all that other stuff that they were using to control the site.
Oh, okay. In these emergency situations, you know, the public, you know, we look on our television screens, et cetera, and we see people coming. What is it that in these types of emergency situations, what can the public do? Or is there any way that the public can help in these crisis situations?
Actually, in almost every crisis situation, the very first responders aren't police, fire, and EMS. The very first responders are your neighbors. They're the ones that come in and can help you. So working for FEMA, we have a ready.gov kit that we suggest that everyone go on FEMA's website, ready.gov, and download just a list of things that you need to make sure that you are self-sufficient, that you are not someone that we have to take care of.
All right, right. Okay, exactly.
And it comes down to medications, food, water, pet supplies, those kinds of things. The second thing is to check on your neighbors to make sure that, they are okay before you do that. So that you, I don't want to say that people are a drain on the system, but the fewer people that we have to worry about, the more work we can do to get the systems
exactly.
back up in play.
Right, because it takes up your time if you have to worry about someone who is not cognizant of, the needs.
Yeah, so I'll give you one small example. It's not a small example, but in the most recent hurricanes in, Puerto Rico, there were 113 people in Puerto Rico that were on, dialysis. We had to charter a plane and fly them out of Puerto Rico over to Miami to get dialysis. Now, the reason that they needed it was because there was no electricity and things like that. And there was really no way we could have prevented that. But if there were, if this, the state or the communities or the individuals or the hospitals had backup generators that could last for a couple of days.
Right.
Those kinds of things. So think about being independent for 3 to 4 days, and that helps us. Make sure, and the sad part about our country right now is that there's probably a preponderance of our population couldn't put their hands on $500 in cash
right.
to help themselves.
Exactly.
And so we first ask people, before they want to go help us, help themselves and help their neighbors.
Exactly, exactly.
And there are, each community has something called a emergency planning committee, and LEPC they call them, and you can contact your local community LEPC and say, I'm Dr. Strobert, I have these skills, I'm a counselor, I can do this stuff, and in an emergency they will call you, but they have your credentials ahead of time.
Right.
They know who you are.
So they've already screened.
Correct. As opposed to, for example, in 9/11, we had people showing up with pet dogs that they said were search animals. And,
oh, my.
You know, or they were doctors or nurses. And maybe they were. I'm sure they were. But how do you know?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And when we you reflect on 9/11 again, what might have been or some of the lingering effects of that traumatic experience on people?
I think that if you look at the history of war, if you look at the history of disasters in the world, you'll find that people handle these kinds of things differently.
Right.
Even in our own lives, when we suffer tragedies, some members of our own family handle them one way and others a little bit differently. So I think it's as individual as your fingerprints. There were a number of men and women, first responders, who had suffered post-traumatic incidents, stress incidents. They were provided counseling. Some of them are still getting counseling. Some of them had to leave their job because they just, it was the stress of that event that had put them in a situation where they didn't feel that they could continue to do that kind of work.
Right.
Others took it as a part of their daily going to work and coming back from work. As you and I spoke, I don't go back there. I go back to New York City. I go back to Jersey City, but I don't go to the Trade Center.
I have to admit, I have never gone to the site. I've gone near the site.
Yeah.
But I just. There's just something that goes through me that says, I'm not ready to go there.
Yeah. And you know, I choose to put that in a part of my brain that I don't go to. But, you know, I was in the fire department for 25 years. I was in the Army for 2 years. So, you know, this was not the first kind of event like that I was at.
But certainly, and, you know, for the country, it was just a traumatic experience.
Yeah.
And even now, you know, when we have the anniversary of 9/11, and to see the buildings, to see the fires, and the people fleeing, it happened yesterday.
The interesting thing I do when I talk to the public safety folks, I tell them that, I ask them this question, I said, how old were you How far back when you were a child? What's the first memory you had? How old are you when you have a memory of going on a vacation or the first day of school? Mm-hmm. And most people say 5 or 6 years old. I said, okay, today's college graduate has absolutely no memory of 9/11. 9/11 to them is as ancient as the Peloponnesian War. It's a story that their parents told them. And it's just vivid to those of us who were adult enough to remember.
Right. And so in some ways, the media helps us to remember or to recall or to help those younger people
to know
what the story is and what their parents or grandparents mm-hmm. may have been talking to them about.
Sure.
Yeah.
And if you go on the History Channel and you see, you know, the bombing of Pearl Harbor or the invasion of Normandy in World War II, I mean, those don't mean anything to you and me except something that we saw on television, our parents told us about.
Yeah. When I think about the experience and 9/11, in some ways there's nothing that can prepare us for those types of disasters.
Probably not. And we work very hard. We're part of the Department of Homeland Security. And the men and women who work in Homeland Security work very hard. Border Protection, TS, Transportation Security Agency, the Coast Guard, Customs and Immigration, to screen, to make sure that that our country is safe. But Tom Ridge was the first Secretary of Homeland Security, the former governor
here.
Of Pennsylvania. And he said, we have to be right a million times a day. They only have to be right once in their life.
Well, that brings me to another question, and that is for those people who would be responsible for responding first.
Yeah.
How has the training changed in light of 9/11? And if you could share some of that.
All right, so there's a couple of things first when you talk about 9/11. First of all, the New York City Fire Department responded to the World Trade Center on average 13 times a day. Mm-hmm. So going to the World Trade Center on fire was not something new to the New York City Fire Department.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, no high-rise building in the history of building construction ever collapsed. So their faith in the building was based on their experience and their knowledge.
Right.
The third piece is, and we all knew it, those buildings were built to withstand a crash from a plane. The reason that they were was because in 1946, I believe, or 45, a World War II bomber crashed into the Empire State Building. And so the Trade Center was built to withstand a hit from a plane. And all of those planes coming back from Europe would fly over the Verrazano. You know the trip, right? They make a right at the Trade Center. The calculation that was not included was the calculation of the fuel. Because when the planes come back from Europe, they're near close to empty.
Right.
So they figured fuel wasn't going to be a factor. But these planes were full of fuel when they hit. And
that made the difference.
That was what collapsed the buildings. It wasn't the plane crash. Because if you look at the event, the planes hit the buildings and they stood. It was the fuel fires that caused the steel to twist and bend, and then the thing came down. So that is the 2001 event. But we had Hurricane Katrina. We had Hurricane Sandy. We've had school shootings, horrible things, tornadoes, and we're constantly learning from those events and improving the training to deal with them. So we're right now revising our manuals, our training manuals on school shootings. They call them mass casualty events.
Yes.
But it used to be that, for example, our law enforcement, I'll be careful about it, but our law enforcement brothers and sisters used to take a certain kind of action when there was a school shooting.
Right.
They've changed that.
Right. Okay.
And it was reported in the news that in a recent event where a police officer didn't go in. Now police officers go in by themselves to take out the shooters. Okay. Previously the emergency medical services folks had certain ways that they responded.
Right.
Those have changed in the last year. So we're changing our tactics, and I don't want to tell you what they are because but we're constantly changing our tactics, reviewing the events, so that we're better prepared, better trained to deal with the next one.
Exactly. Well, I can't believe our time is up.
Oh, is it really?
I'm sorry, okay. Already?
Did I talk too much?
No, not at all.
Do they know that we're from the same area?
No, we won't say. Say that. But it certainly you've given us some insight as to the 9/11 as well as post 9/11 and what we've learned from that event. So I'm very appreciative of your time with us.
Well, thank you for your gift of time.
Okay, my guest today has been Dr. Dennis O'Neill, who is the Deputy Fire Administrator for the U.S. Fire Administration in Emmitsburg, Maryland, and we were discussing 9/11 and post 9/11 events. For the Seminary Explorers, this is Nelson Strobert. Have a good day.
You have been listening to The Seminary Explorers, a production of United Lutheran Seminary with campuses in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, and Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. We invite you to visit our website at unitedlutheranseminary.edu. Opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of United Lutheran Seminary or the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America.